Welcome to The Liberated Life, the podcast for women who are done pretending that they have it all figured out and are ready to live with more freedom, clarity, and courage. I'm Lucy Maeve, your guide on a journey through the unspoken parts of healing, desire, and self-discovery. This is a place to be seen, heard, and held, where we embrace all the complexities and contradictions of being fully alive. No masks, no shortcuts, just the real work and real liberation. Hello, my lovely one. It is so great to be back here with you today. And we have got such a good episode for you today. I'm so excited. So you might remember back during Trollgate when I posted that reel about my experience of having been the other woman. There was a very wonderful lady who commented on that reel and said that she had written her dissertation on the topic of the experience of the other woman in a triangular relationship. And that lovely woman was Dr. Holly Simmons. And we have Dr. Holly Simmons on the podcast today to talk to us about her research and what she found in her dissertation as she was exploring the experience of the other woman. This episode is so powerful and so needed. We dive into so much of the data, really, around this. And we're diving into the motivation behind becoming the other woman, why it happens, why it's so difficult to leave. We talk about compassion, we talk about shame, we talk about the isolation, we talk about how people actually get out. And my hope is that this episode is such a salve to so many of you and also opens the eyes of many others who perhaps have different views on this topic. So it's such an honour to be in this conversation with Dr. Holly Simmons. So to give you a little bit of background on her, she is a clinical psychologist and mother. She's licensed in the USA and the UK, where she has a private practice supporting people to live healthier and happier lives. She's passionate about helping families raise their emotional intelligence and does incredible work with children and with parents to really raise the EQ of the nation. And as she was studying, wrote this incredible dissertation on this very topic. So with that, let's dive in. I hope you enjoy this. And I hope you glean a lot from it. And yeah, I would love to know what lands for you when you get to the end. So please do let me know. Hello, my lovelies. I'm so excited to have Holly here. Holly was trolled with me on that post. She came in with a really supportive message about how she had written a thesis about being the other woman and like, well, what's actually going on with the other woman. And she got taken down by the trolls almost as badly as I did. So I'm so honoured that she's here with us today. And I'm really, really excited to dive into this conversation with you.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I feel the same. Yeah, definitely wasn't expecting to get trolled in that way, but was also, you know, interesting and got a few more people that figured out who I was on that little corner of the internet. So, you know, but all the more reason to talk about this and to, I'm just glad that I wrote my dissertation on it. And we'll talk about this later, but I actually turned my dissertation into a self-help book and never published it. And now I'm thinking maybe there's a space for that.
100%. 100%.
Quite fun. So I'm happy to be here.
Amazing. So I'd love to know, I guess the purpose of this episode really is to dive into some of the research that you did, because I know that there's so much taboo about being the other woman. I know from the number of messages I got after that reel went viral that there are so many people that struggle with this. And I really want to give space to like the, I guess, like more of the academic side to it, slightly, because I know that I've spoken a lot about it from my own perspective and like my sense of things, but I think it's really important to give space to, yeah, the work that you've done, to see like how common it is really and what's potentially going on. So I guess to start with, can I ask, what exactly is triangulation in the context of love and relationships, and how common is it really?
So I think we have to be careful of the word triangulation, because triangulation in psychology can mean multiple things. It can be triangulation within a family, so a parent triangulates a child. And really, when we look at triangulation in that context, it's a manipulation tactic. So we can say that, yes, there's triangulation, there's some manipulation, but that third person in that case, it might not be a romantic option or relationship. It might be actually a child being pulled up into the parental relationship, right? Or someone from the outside in that capacity. But what we're really looking at is more of like a love triangle where there is actual romantic entanglement. So like the feelings in that are real, they're messy, and they're not usually strategic. Now, they, you know, there is also a part where they can be more manipulative or strategic. But I think that's something that I want to kind of clear up when we talk about that, that triangulation itself can be something slightly different. So I always talk about it as the other woman in a triangular relationship.
Okay. And in terms of triangular relationships, how common are they?
Yeah. So that would be one where there's three people. So what I kind of think it's helpful for me to just lay out for you guys, the listeners and you, my research and kind of what it was. So my research was a qualitative study, and I wanted to research this because I saw so often in my career in advertising, young women being in these relationships. A lot of times they were with sort of more powerful men. And I was really interested into why the woman was always treated so poorly and the men would get like raises, et cetera, and the women would have to leave their job. So I had research questions like, what motivates young unmarried women to become involved in a relationship with a married man? What motivates them to stay? Because a lot of times it was a long-term relationship that they were in. And then you know, did they find the relationship emotionally distressing, or was there something keeping them there? And what was the sort of subjective and external influences leading to the termination of the relationship? Like, how did they end up leaving in the end? And what I found in my literature review was that there's literally hardly any studies done on the other woman. So most of the studies done are dissertations or theses.
Wow.
Which to me is just, you know, when we look at like what happened to us when we talked about it on like all I said was having compassion for people, all people, and was trolled for that. And it's really interesting because I think there's so much societal blame and big feelings that come up for everyone around this issue. So I think that's really important to kind of understand. So some of the stuff that I'm going to quote is things that are from quite a long time ago. And that's because there is like hardly any research in this area.
So can I ask, when you say there isn't very much research in this area, is that specifically about the other woman? And there is research about like affairs within marriage, but it's not focused on the other woman?
Yes, exactly.
Oh my God, this like breaks my heart. I'm like, there's a whole experience here that isn't spoken to.
Yes, yes. And that breaks my heart as well, which is why I did this. I just felt like, how could, there's this whole person that we just essentially, people decide are home wreckers, but that's not always the case. And you're going to hear, actually, it's really not the case in what I found in the research that I sort of looked at in the literature review I did.
So homewreckers and also like irrelevant, like deemed to be irrelevant by academia.
Yes. Which is like, what? Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So it's sort of, it was estimated in 1988. So this was one of the studies done, that between 20 to 35% of the 33 million single women in America would have a relationship with a married man. So
wow.
It is really common.
Wait, 25 to 30%?
20 to 35%.
20, 35%. Oh, and what age range was that, sorry?
So there isn't an age range. It's just estimated that single women would at some point in their lives be in a relationship with a married man. And statistically, in 1981, Nass, Libby, and Fisher looked at the like extramarital affairs. So like you said, there was more research on that. And it's estimated that 50 to 65% of married men engage in extramarital affairs at some point in their life.
Like, I kind of wish we were recording the video right now because my jaw is like fully on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's way more common than anyone talks about. And I think part of that is we're going to talk about when we get into some of the other questions about the shame that comes from it and the psychological effects of it and why.
Like, even you just sharing those statistics, I'm like, the number of women who have contacted me, like, deep in shame, feeling that there's something, like, inherently wrong with them, that they're bad, like, just those statistics in themselves is, like, the biggest exhale in the world.
Yeah. I know. It's such an important topic to talk about, too. Like, I do a lot on emotional intelligence, and I feel like if we actually were more emotionally intelligent in the way that we looked at ourselves, but our relationships and the way that we engaged with others, like, there'd be just so much more communication around what's really going on for the person who is cheating and the person who's the other woman and the woman who's also in that relationship. So I also should highlight, my study was done with heterosexual relationships. So I looked at men married to women having the affair and the woman who was the other woman in that relationship.
Okay. And when you look at the women who are the other woman in this dynamic, is there like a theme in terms of like attachment patterns, relational patterns, or anything that leads them into that scenario?
So I wouldn't say there's a theme of attachment patterns, but there is a bit of a theme of how the relationship starts. So in my study, as well as the studies that come up in my dissertation through the literature review, almost all of the relationships start as friends, and the man seeks out the woman. And in my study, there were eight women. It took me multiple years to find eight women. It was the hardest part of my dissertation was finding the people.
Wow.
Because, and now I'm like, I wish I did my dissertation when I knew you now, because we could create
a whole community. We could do like a whole thing.
Maybe we'll write another dissertation. But ultimately, it took me almost 3 years to find eight people. I almost gave up on it in the end, and then I was able to do it, and I'm really glad I did. But what in my study, all but one of the women met the man at work. The closest age gap was 8 years. The men were all 8 years or more older than the women. And I think that that's a real, we can talk about power dynamics in a bit, but they were at work, they became friends, the men went after the women. There was a power dynamic of age at work. But the other thing that was common in the relationships was that they were given something kind of they were lacking in their life. They were feeling special because of their relationship. So I think if we're looking at what was a pattern, what might be coming to the surface, it's things that were sort of the major motivation in the beginning of the relationship. So I want to say that because I think that's important. It's the beginning that this happens. But all of the women felt really special in the relationship, and it provided them with something they were looking for. And that relationship was a source of additional happiness in their lives. So it started out as something that was fulfilling, whether that was sort of the friendship that turned into the relationship, the kind of hope that.
And is that special? Is that the specialness piece? Is that when the friendship is formed, or is that at the point where the friendship turns into something
more? Where it turns into something more.
It's so interesting because the number of people who have contacted me, I should probably keep track, but I don't. I swear like 70% of them, the person is at work.
Yeah.
They all seem to be at work and they all seem to be a lot older than them. And they're, obviously I don't know the depths of the situations, but there were a lot of themes of like power.
Yes. So I'm going to just quickly pull up my little chart that I have because I think this is really interesting. I did a chart on like the women that were in my study. Mm. And hold on. It's all the same. So they were at work. One met them on holiday, but that was a kind of a rare occurrence. Mm. So it was definitely... I think there's a large power dynamic. And the other thing that happened was a lot of deceit. So in my sample, all of the women were told the men were going to leave. But interestingly, statistically, only 1% of men ever leave their wife for the other woman.
And yet all of them are saying
all of them had the hope and belief, and they also all the women had the hope and belief the men would leave, and all the men were telling the woman that they would leave.
But this is the piece that's like I really want to focus as much as I can on the experience of the woman and like the stuff that's coming out for the women and the self-responsibility and all of that. And simultaneously, I'm like, it's a bind to find yourself in when you have fallen in love with someone and they are telling you that they're going to leave and the action isn't happening, like to have the courage and self-worth really to step away from that is really hard.
Mm-hmm. So that's the, we'll kind of talk about what happens in this too, because of the isolation and the shame around it. It's really difficult for them to get out and the psychological sort of difficulties that come up because of that. Yeah. So in my study, they all started the relationship. So the women that I spoke to were sort of between the ages of 28 and 36. They all began the relationship in their early 20s, which I think is really interesting because we know a lot more about the frontal lobe of our brain too, and that it's continuously growing and getting stronger. And so I'm not in any way saying that the women when they're young are, you know, making really bad decisions. Like, but what I'm saying is I think there's something to be said about that with that piece of power. Like the men being that much older and the women being young. So they're still kind of in their formative relation, like meeting people and that kind of a thing. And their judgment and decision making is maybe not as strong as it would be when they're 40.
Okay.
Right. That's just a sort of an interesting part to it as well, I think.
So I want to go back briefly on that, what you were saying around the relational pattern stuff and how actually that's less relevant in this. Because I think a lot of people will think, and I did to a certain degree, I definitely felt the specialness thing. And I was like, there was something definitely in it for me around being special. I also wondered whether there was like, I'm kind of afraid of being in a relationship where someone like fully chooses me. So this is maybe slightly easier. Because I remember feeling actually quite afraid when he said that he might leave his wife. I was like, oh God, then I'd be in an actual relationship and that would be terrifying. But perhaps that's just my own experience. But what you're saying is really that the key driver for the women that you studied was this piece around wanting to feel special, that or that they felt special by being chosen as such by this person.
Yeah. And that's where I think the age of the relationship starting is really interesting as well. Just in, you know, if we look at 20-year-old or 22-year-old men and we look at 32-year-old men or 40-year-old men, they're doing really different things. Like women mature a lot faster. Mm. So like if you want to go out to a nice fancy dinner and like feel taken care of in that nice way, right? Like someone doing that for you or with you, you're not going to get that from a 22-year-old. Now, maybe, right? But I think it's less common. So I think there's a bit of that power differential of like, oh, because they, a lot of the women talked about that, like the experiences that they had with these men, you know, the nice dinners or the holidays or the things, the maturity level of the men.
Does that not in some ways link to like a parent-child dynamic of like being looked after?
It's really interesting. The one study that had anything that sort of looked at that and had anything to do with that showed that women who were closer to their fathers were more likely to be the other woman, which is really interesting because it's always been daddy issues that people say as to why you go. But the one study that was I found in my literature review actually had the opposite. It was more likely for a woman who had a hard time with her mother to be
in a relationship. Be the other woman. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Now, like I said, there's not enough research out there. So the thing is that this is for sure what it is. It's just a conversation around this is what's out there. This is what it's shown so far.
Yeah. And what about the piece about power? Because I've had, I'd say like at least 10 messages from women over the course of the last, I can't remember when that post went out, but a few months at least, talking to me about like kind of elements of manipulation, mm-hmm. and elements of like them not really having wanted to be in the relationship at the start, but somehow having ended up in the relationship. And I look back in my own experience of that, and that was definitely a similar dynamic for me. And I look back and I was like, why wasn't I strong enough? Like, why didn't I say no for long enough? Like, why did I end up giving in? But it seems like that's a pattern. Like when I hear from all these other women that it was similar, and you're saying that there was an element of that too in the research that you looked at.
Yeah. And I think, let's think about it just in general. Like, think how many times you maybe went on a second date or dated someone for longer than you thought you would because they kept persevering, right? Like, I feel like that is, I mean, I don't know, this is a totally different study, but maybe we go into sort of depths on people pleasing or giving more than you want to someone. You know, there's so many levels of it. But I think within my study, the power dynamic showed up in quite a lot of ways. One, it was, yes, it was like they pursued the woman. The woman was younger. They were in sort of more powerful positions at work. Mm. But not only that, what happened once they were in is something that I think is so interesting that we lose, that we forget about. And that's the power that comes from keeping someone secret, right? So all of a sudden this woman has no one to talk to because there's no, she doesn't want to admit to anyone that she's in this relationship. Maybe there's one or two people, but usually if she tells someone, it goes into the sort of troll shaming, how could you do this? They don't love you. Why are you doing this? Which then creates a more difficult psychological dynamic for the person involved in it, right?
What is the impact of that when you're received in that way? In the like, this person doesn't love you, you shouldn't be doing this. Like, what's the impact of that on the person?
Well, it's really interesting. A lot of the women had pretty severe psychological difficulties at the end. There was a study, a dissertation done previously to mine, where one of the women talked about suicidality and wanting to die afterwards because she Wow. had so much shame and fear around actually coming forward. In my study, there were stories about when the woman came sort of out and talked about it, the people around, similar to you, what happened with you, you know, sharing this online and people you don't even know telling you you should die.
Yeah.
You know, this, it's really intense. And so you take the person who's just experienced the loss of a relationship that, you know, they thought they had and the difficulty with leaving that relationship in any way. And then you add on top people telling them they're bad people. Because that's the thing. I think we're so quick in society to talk about the other woman as like a homewrecker, good or bad. You know, the mistress is a terrible person. Mm. But it's way more complex than that. And we don't talk about the man cheating in that same way.
No, there's never any. I mean, that's not entirely fair. Maybe that was just my experience of the industry that I worked in. But it was like the balance was definitely off in terms of responsibility.
Yeah. Well, and I saw that, and I worked in a totally different I mean, I saw that in advertising and you were in finance. So it's, you know, I think it's probably more common than we think. But then it also, we have to look at things like what happens in the longer these relationships last. So I think one of the key things is these are not one-off quick relationships. The relationships last and they last a long time. So the shortest in my study was 1 year and the longest was 20. Ongoing, and she'd already been in it for from 22 to 35, and it was still going on. And one of them was 10 years. So, I mean, most of them, I think the mean, I can't remember exactly, but I think it was about 6 years, which is wild to me. You know, these are lasting a long time. These are not like quick, I'm just going to cheat and ruin this marriage, right? This is a real relationship that's happening for these women.
I feel like that's the piece that, like, when I've spoken to people about this online, like, I feel like the piece that is so often missed is, like, there can be real love there. Like, I genuinely believe that there can be. Yeah. And I feel like that's so often missed, that it's like, oh, it's not a real relationship. It's like, it doesn't mean anything. It's like, no, I genuinely believe that the feelings can be real and it can also be quite complicated, which kind of leads me to think that we just try to oversimplify human relating in general.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think that what I found was there was a fear of being alone. Or without love that emerged as a theme throughout the women's stories. This is when I sort of asked, why did you stay in the relationship? And that fear stemmed from feelings of sort of emotional or financial dependency, the idea of having another relationship for themselves that was satisfying, or the fear of being alone or without love. So you talked about that piece, I think, more of like having a different relationship that might be satisfying felt a bit scary. And I think some of them, I think that is for some people part of it, but it's also more complex than that for others.
Well, yeah, I guess the initial fear has got to be around like the fear of loss of the relationship, which kind of exists in any relationship, but the complexity with being the other woman is often that the guy isn't going to end it necessarily. So then it ends up that all the onus is on the woman.
Yep. And then you've not told anyone in your world. So think about when you go through a breakup regularly in life, right? When it's not a secretive relationship. Everyone, your girlfriends surround you, you go out, you have girls' weekends. Let's say you go through a divorce, okay? So it's a big, because these relationships are lasting 10, you know, sometimes 10 or more years. So it's like a divorce for these women. It's not in that they don't live with them, but a lot of the women saw the men quite frequently because a lot of the jobs were big jobs where they were working all the time and they were with them at work.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a lot of them did holidays together. So they're big relationships. And I think we often forget like who supports them. A lot of these women were afraid to tell psychologists about it. They didn't even want to tell their therapist because they have the fear of judgment and shame. So then where do you go and how do you get the support for the loss of this? It's almost like the other woman is leading two lives.
Yeah, completely. And I've had that in messages from a lot of women that they've not told anyone. Yeah. And they're in therapy and have like supportive friendships, but they have not told anyone because of the fear of like shaming, I guess, and of like believing so deeply that there must be something so terribly wrong with them that they don't feel like there's anyone they can talk to. But in that isolation, like, I get, we're a tribal species, right? So it's like we need to be surrounded by people to be able to find the strength to leave something as complicated as this.
And I think so often there's so much sort of shame and guilt that then lowers your self-esteem over time. And the longer you've kept something a secret, the harder it becomes and the more isolated you feel. And I think it sort of plays on top of that, right? It continues to become more difficult. And then you're like, this is something else that came up. When that happens, then the woman's like, I can't leave. This has to work because it was for love.
Yeah.
right?
Like, I can't possibly have been in this thing and then it end up actually, I can't prove everyone right. Everyone told me that he'd never leave. I can't prove them right. Yeah.
And then this is this really tricky thing because they lose this. The thing that I found really sad, and this is my own feelings, right? So that's the other thing. And we can talk about this because I think there's a way to communicate with people that it leaves your own stuff at home. Mm-hmm. But in bringing, clearly stating, I am bringing my own feelings and opinions, but I felt really sad for some of the women who they basically stayed with this man for the years. Like, let's say they wanted to have children.
Yeah.
They got beyond that and they could no longer do that. And that just feels so sad to me that because we couldn't open the conversation and allow people to be real and say, this is what's going on for me, they may get stuck in a cycle that then loses them the opportunity to have a healthy, happy relationship, have children, you know, experience life in a better way, because when you can't share part of your life, I mean, a big part of your life, right? You lack that, you know, you're still alone. You're going to weddings alone. You're doing Christmas alone, you know, whatever it is you celebrate, right? Yeah. You're doing a lot of life alone, but almost worse because you're more lonely because there's someone you want to be spending it with.
And then that ends up like spiraling downwards over a period of time and making it harder and harder to.
Yeah.
Because I guess to get out of this kind of dynamic, you really need to be like bolstering self-worth as much as you can to feel strong enough to get out.
But the longer you are in something and it's not going the way you believed it would, the lower your self-esteem and the higher the shame and guilt.
My heart hurts. My heart also hurts because I have so many friends that have been in this dynamic, and I like really hear myself in everything that you've shared, and I also hear all my friends and everything you've shared and all the women that have contacted me, and I actually feel quite angry that so often infidelity is oversimplified. And I understand why there is so much focus on looking at the relational dynamics between the, like, in inverted commas, exclusive couple, and like understanding why that broke down to a degree, or why someone decides to go outside of their marriage. But there is almost like there's this ghost figure that's like left and like is trying to navigate an incredibly complicated situation with no support. And just completely alone.
Yeah. And like, it's big stuff. Like, the women reported things like panic attacks, overwhelming fear, sadness, feeling empty or lost, an overwhelming sense of being alone to the termination of the relationship. And
what does that mean? Alone to the termination of the
relationship? So like being alone after it ends.
Okay.
That sort of fear with that.
Well, I guess that makes so much sense, because if you've been having to hide so much for such a long time, your relationships with your friends, even if you are still close to them, they've distanced to a certain degree because you've been hiding a whole portion of your life.
Yeah, and then how do you tell them you did that? Because then they're going to be angry at you because you lied to them. And now you've got another dynamic of friends and loved ones who are angry at you because you kept them out. But you had to, because to tell them would be to like be in that shame and guilt. And they would probably say to you, don't do it, leave. They don't love you. Right. And they, in some ways they might be right. But in other ways, I mean, it's way more complicated than that.
What stops, I don't know whether this is in your research or if it's not, we can just skip over it. But I'm wondering, so if there's this initial dynamic of someone wanting to feel special at the start and feeling special in the initial period of the relationship, what is it that makes it become a really long-term thing? Because you'd think like
why don't
special, I kind of feel special, but now like I actually am going to leave because this person is with someone else. Like, is there something that results in the longevity of the relationship?
Yeah, so I did a whole part on motivation for staying, like why do they stay? And the themes that came up were denial, unspoken boundaries of what was going on, sort of not engaging with what was actually right in front of them, right? So the boundary of like, I don't call my boyfriend when he's at home with his wife kind of thing. A fear of being alone or without love was another one. And so I think what the theme showed that in the beginning, these relationships really were quite positive. But then as the relationships progressed, the themes became sort of more reflective of negative feelings. And that compounded with the inability to have the strength to get out. So many of the women in my study tried multiple times to leave the relationship and wow. ended up back. And if you think about that, it makes some sense, right? Because you have this narrative in your mind that you can't be the quote unquote homewrecker. It was a real situation. It was real love. You did this for real love. Mm-hmm. And then you work with that person. And for a lot of people, they do have a real love for this man. So if you break, like, let's say you go through a breakup in a different scenario and you work with that person or you see that person every day, it's hard to stay broken up. Like, sometimes you break up and get back together, right? Because you see each other. So now you've got the power dynamic on top of the kind of love, on top of the seeing each other every day. And I think it's quite tricky.
Because it's almost like, I know that the early stages of any relationship, the like chemicals in the system are kind of like basically the same as being like a coke addict or something. Yeah. Crazy chemicals. So you think like actually at the start, you're kind of, and then you're with them all the time. So you're constantly having that release of whatever it is that gets released. And so that kind of hooks you in, especially if they're in your workplace.
Yeah. And I think there's a, you know, different kinds of relationships. So there's the emotional ones, which are going to give a little bit of a different, but then there's also the sexual and emotional ones. And when we orgasm in sex, you release oxytocin, which is the attachment love hormone. So you got to remember too, the more you're having sort of sex in that capacity and you are orgasming, especially for the woman, you're really starting to bind that attachment, which then is even harder to break from. It's interesting. Some of the women talked about in their therapy doing sort of addiction type therapeutic work to get out, which is why I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I think there's a way to support these women in writing a self-help book so that you don't have to necessarily go to your therapist, but there's someone saying, okay, try this and then this to get you out, because it is exactly that. The hormones are also a part of it.
Well, because this is entirely from my own experience, but there is a piece of like, because you never get to the stability. So there's never like, my understanding is like in a normal, healthy relationship, there is a period at the beginning where your hormones are all over the place. There is a lot of like bonding stuff going on that means that you then end up bound together to a certain degree and you have this attachment to them. And then the hormones start to settle and you come into a space of more like neutrality to a certain degree. Whereas if the person is never fully available to you, there is a constant spike of stress. And then relief when you see them again, and stress and relief. And that's the same as an addictive pattern, right? It's like, I feel all this pain. I need the thing to stop the pain. And it just keeps repeating over and over and over again.
Yeah. I know.
I'm feeling really sad.
I wish people could see your face in this one as well.
I'm just like, I'm actually feeling really sad for the version of me that went through all of this, like however many years ago it was. Because I'm like, it was really hard.
Yeah, it was. And I think that that's actually, I think we should honor space for the sadness, but also you should be really proud of your strength. And the fact that, you know, realizing too that there wasn't something wrong with you. This was an experience.
I want to unpick this "there wasn't something wrong with you" piece, because I know that some of the wonderful people that will be listening to this will be going, yeah, but there still probably is something wrong with me. So if the motivation initially is like a friendship that then turns into something else, and a lot of the time the motivation is this piece around feeling special, what drives someone to want to feel special?
Well, we all want to feel special. All we want in life is to be seen and heard, right? That is the number one driver of life. Like, so I do a lot of work with families and kids. Actually, that's where my focus in my sort of work as a psychologist is. This just happened to be something that I was interested in for my dissertation research. But when we look at that, I am always explaining to parents, like, children, they need to feel seen and heard, whatever their experience is. We all need that, right? In all of the things we go through in life, we want people to just actually be able to see and hear us. So that's why I work a lot with things like active listening, and really creating a space where you leave your own feelings aside when you see someone and you hear someone. So you're actually there validating their experience, whatever it is. It might not be that you believe it's right or wrong, right? But actually validating that that's their subjective experience. And we all have really different subjective experiences. And that's where, when you work with trauma, you notice that two people can go through the same war experience and one come with really significant trauma and one not.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a, you know, war is kind of an extreme example, but like it can happen with all sorts of little things. Something that might seem little to you or I might be traumatic to someone else. And that's because we all have our own subjective experience and we want to feel seen, heard, loved. I mean, that's the human experience.
But these relationships allow you to feel extra seen, heard, and loved to a certain degree.
I would say probably to, I mean, maybe. I think that's the problem with that, is it's kind of a blanket statement, right? But I think you probably do. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're going on a lot of dates in your life and you're not feeling seen or heard in those, that connection. And then you've got this person that you're friends with at work who keeps coming after you, and they kind of see you in a different way. You have an understanding of each other through work, right? You have this connection in that capacity. And then all of a sudden you feel a bit more seen and heard in the beginning.
I feel like that is going to resonate with quite a lot of people, because from both my own experience and having, again, spoken to quite a few people online about this, it feels like there is a pattern of, like, struggling in normal, in inverted commas, dating, and, like, not finding anyone they really connect with, and then suddenly this person kind of swooping in, and in many ways, like, acting out the, like, Disney... the Disney thing, you know, like this, it's suddenly you have this like knight in shining armor who probably has quite a lot more money than you if they're a lot older than you, like has more power, has more power. And I remember my partner was telling me that there was some study done talking about, like, it wasn't really about fetishes, but it was like what women really fantasize about. And like, if you look at all the like novels that women read that are in some ways about romance to a certain degree, there are certain archetypes. I can't remember what all of them are, but one of them is a billionaire. One of them is like a werewolf. And another one is like, I don't know, a caveman or something. And basically it was just these archetypes of what we find super attractive, because there's some sense of, and I think in the modern day, maybe the werewolf is less relevant, but like, money breeds power and safety. As women, we're all in some ways looking for someone that we can feel safe with. And we think that if they have money and power, then we'll be safe.
Yeah, I think that can be part of it for sure. And I think that it's, you know, and I think that's the thing, we like to put people and things in boxes to make them make sense.
Yes.
Right. So our brain categorizes to sort of make us feel exactly that, safe, right? Change or difference creates, our amygdala says fear, fear, fear. So there's a reason why people sit in the same spot in the yoga class all of the time. And that's because change, even tiny change like that, will sort of spike up that response of, wait a minute, this is different. Should I be afraid? Is this okay? Right. So we want to put people in boxes. We want to get rid of the gray area of what these relationships could actually mean, because it's it makes more sense. And I think for our brains, right, it makes more sense that we put them in that. And I think that that goes for the women, and I didn't study them, but I can imagine that, you know, for women who've been cheated on, we need reason. And it's really, it's a lot easier to say, it's not my husband, I want to stay with him, and say, it's her. She did this. She came in and ruined my marriage. When actually, if we used self-awareness more in general, which is something I am so passionate about, we could all learn from these experiences. Everyone, like, it could make relationships stronger. Like, there's Esther Perel, she does a lot of work on this, and she says that, and she does it more not from the other woman's perspective, but she talks a lot about that sometimes infidelity can be the, like, catalyst to change that really, like, fixes a relationship. And that's if you're willing to look at it and say, what was it that I was lacking within my partnership? And if we use self-awareness in general in our partnerships over and over as we grow and change, we'll be having that conversation and we'll actually know what we need in a better way. And same with the women experiencing being the other woman. If they're using self-awareness to say, what is it that I want in a relationship? And then going after that rather than the, you know, what society might think they should have, or checking the boxes of, do they have hair or not hair? Right. You know, those bits, to actually look at the deeper things of what do you need and want. And having that self-awareness, I think, is really kind of important.
Yeah. It's such a, God, I feel like we should all get together and have a chat. But I have two friends who, we have like one woman in each camp. So I have a friend who cheated on her husband. I have a friend whose partner cheated on her, and now they are back together and having a baby. And then me. So we've had this whole conversation of, like, actually, each of us have found ways to heal through what happened through the lens of self-awareness. Of, like, it is very easy to, and I recognize that the experience of being the other woman is very complicated, but it is also very easy to go, it was all their fault. Like, I was manipulated into it. I had no self-responsibility. And yes, there is complexity. And yes, it's not an easy thing to move through. And simultaneously, I can only speak from my own experience, but there was a part of me that didn't feel very special in myself. And I probably could have done some stuff around my self-worth that might have supported me in not being in that dynamic. And that really helped me after my own situation with it, because it supported me to grow in that way. And I know that my friend who ended up back with her partner that had cheated on her has this experience of, like, I mean, I was controlling him all the time. And I was, like, super emasculating. And there was a lot of stuff that she recognized that she was doing, and stuff that he was doing as well, that was, like, of course their relationship was in some ways ruptured. But it feels like we don't have the right relational awareness in society at large to understand. Like, it feels like people just think, you get together, you live together, you've signed a piece of paper, so therefore, like, you're together forever. Mm-hmm. Without having awareness or understanding of, like, what it actually takes to build a solid relationship.
Yeah, and to continue over time, right? Because we change and grow, we become different people throughout our lives. You know, there's a, you know, I work with families, and I'm a mother of two young kids, and I am constantly preaching about the fact that you basically shed the person you were, and you become when you become a mother, and we don't give enough time and space to that. And then all of a sudden in your partnership, there's more than just you and your partner, right? There's these little humans that need 100% of your time. And what does that look like? And how do you become, you know, you're different. So your partner's gonna be like, you're different. I hear that a lot. Like, my wife's no longer my wife after having kids. She's not fun anymore. She nags, or all these things, right? But you're like, but hold on. There's, like, a whole different, everybody's different.
Yeah.
Let's have self-awareness around relationships and talk about that there's more to a relationship than black and white, than married, than not, than single, right? There is a huge area for us to really focus in and say, hey, let's look at let's look at our relationship, look at ourselves, what do we need, etc. And it's really interesting. That's where I love using active listening. And one of the things that I use within that is something that I'm going to totally botch her name. It's Hedy, I think, Schiffler. So she has this technique, and there's a TED talk on it. So we can find it and link it in the show notes, or people can look for it. But basically, it's called Crossing the Bridge. Mm. And I love it. I use it a lot because it's a really great way to think about active listening, where you and helping someone be seen and heard, right? So basically, the idea is you can only, you one like you're on that side of the bridge, I'm over here. There's something that we're talking about. So I am going to come across to your side. I'm only able to cross with my passport in a clear plastic bag. Everything else, all my stuff stays on this side, which is really hard to do.
So
all
fun.
My beliefs, all my everything, my feelings are not here. They're just, and I cross over to you and I listen with active listening intently, where I might hear you saying something and repeat it back. And you might say, no, that's not what I'm saying. Mm. And I keep doing that until I hear what you are saying.
Our couple therapist has us do this all the time. She's like, yeah. Now just mirror back what Thomas said. Yeah. And we're like, the whole conversation, just mirror back what he just said. Just mirror back what she said.
Yeah.
It's like, and then after a few months, Thomas was like, this, I mean, I was kind of annoyed by it at the beginning, but it's actually really good, isn't it?
But it works with your kids too. That's the crazy thing. And your friendships. Because we often hear, right? I said we each have our subjective experience. So we're hearing with our own stuff, not what someone's saying. So someone might say, you look beautiful today. And you might hear,
he wants to have sex with me.
She normally thinks I look like shit.
Yeah.
Oh, I just swore. Sorry.
Bleep. No, it's fine.
But yeah, so I think it's that thing, right, of having an experience and being open to someone's actual experience, yeah, rather than saying they did this because they're broken.
Mm.
There's something wrong with them. They have a bad attachment style. They are in this, like, it's not as, we can't wrap it up and tie in a bow like that.
No. I mean, we can't wrap up and tie up a bow the human experience. I saw something the other day that was talking about male vulnerability. And I don't know why I had this like really visceral response to this thing that I saw. And it was talking about like how male vulnerability is so important. And I was like, I think I'm over the word vulnerability. So I was like, can we just call it humanness? Because it's not anything. It's not like, whoa, we've walked into the vulnerability room. It's like, no, that's just being a human being that feels things, because that's inherent in being a human being.
So true. Yeah, that's actually, let's stop stuffing.
Yeah.
Let's stop pushing things under the rug and actually engage in the experience of being human, which is messy, right?
So messy. And I've got one last question for you.
Yeah.
So as we kind of talked a little bit about that, I think that it's often oversimplified, like infidelity is oversimplified generally. In what way do you feel like it's misunderstood or oversimplified?
When you see this relationship, you mean?
Yeah, like how society looks at the other woman and just infidelity generally. How do you feel like we've oversimplified it?
Well, I think it's that flattened kind of good versus bad judgment put into it.
Mm.
And actually it's messy and layered, and it's deeply tied to all sorts of things, the intimacy, the commitment, right? All of those. And I think some of the things are like, you know, a lot of people think it might be just about the sex. And there's a lot about the emotional side of affairs, and the secrecy or the breaking of trust. And on the woman who is getting cheated on, I think that can be really devastating, and sometimes even more devastating than the physical stuff of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that bit, I think assuming that the betrayed partner was lacking in some way. So like people often frame affairs as evidence that something was sort of missing in the primary relationship, but that's not always true. So I think that's one of the things that we don't look at. Like sometimes the person cheating is having their own internal struggles of an identity crisis or unmet needs, right? It's not about their wife being lacking. But actually, it's about them. And that sort of moralizing purely in black and white. And that's when we tend to say the cheaters are the bad person or the other woman's the bad person. But that ignores the reality that really good people sometimes cheat.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that's a big part of it. I think we overlook cultural and relational context when we're looking at this. Mm-hmm. Like we've been talking about through this, like, you know, in some couples, flirting is a harmless thing and they're okay with it. But others see that as betrayal. So there's also, and different cultures see it differently. Right. And so it's also what's happening in your kind of partnership, your relationship, and what does that look like in your culture, what's accepted, not accepted, right? For what you want.
Mm.
So if you're wanting to be in that culture with that type of relationship, do you see what I mean? Rather than making it sort of a moral black and white thing.
And that to me is like, it's such an important, it goes slightly off topic of being the other woman, but I think just generally it's such an important piece to mention because there is no like guidebook to being in a relationship. And I remember when I first started dating Thomas and we became like official or whatever, I was suddenly like, wait a second. Like I have a rule book in my head of what this now means. He probably has a rule book in his head of what this now means. It's like, we should probably compare rule books because like, and how many couples actually have that conversation of like, what does this actually, like, what is the container of our relationship and what is and isn't okay? So that we're both reading off the same hymn sheet.
Yeah. And I think that's so key for so many things in relationships, like especially in this partnership. And if you decide to grow and become a family with kids.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that look like? What does that continue? I think that is such an important thing that you guys have done and continue. You should continue because that's the other thing that happens. We ignore this possibility of growth. Like growth happens. It happens all the time, but we just assume infidelity just destroys. It's like you said for your girlfriend who cheated. She grew massively, but she had to be open to that and say, hey, I'm going to work on my self-awareness. And like, I have a firm belief that we should be continuing to grow for our whole life. That's the beauty, right? And that's what we should be helping our kids do too. Our families is really to grow. Growth is key. And I think we also, one of the things that comes up is that we forget the complexity of secrecy and what that does in so many different ways. The sort of, like you were talking about, that anticipation, that kind of thrill of being seen differently in this relationship than maybe others that you've had previously. Is there someone who feels maybe more desired than they did in a different capacity, whatever that is, emotionally, sexually, it can be any of those things. And I think the other thing that I want to talk about is those are kind of generalized, but they're not specific to the other woman. But when we're looking at the other woman, culture says they stole the partner. They are predatory or malicious, but that's not the case. And all the research I looked at through my literature review and my dissertation was a qualitative study that showed that's not true. And she didn't take anyone. She was invited into a relationship by someone who was already partnered.
Yeah.
She said yes, but she didn't go after that. And I think the other thing we didn't talk about, but is that in my study and the studies that I saw, the women didn't do this multiple times. I think there's a real thought that this is what they do. This is the kind of only kind of relationship you get into. And that's not the case. Actually, more often than not, they have one and they never want to do it again. And while they don't regret the relationship they had, they wouldn't wish anyone else to go through it.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, we talked about this, but that there can also be genuine love.
Well, that's the point when you just said that they don't necessarily regret the relationship. I think that's a really important piece because, again, it comes back to shame of like, oh, because I did this in inverted commas bad thing, I should see it as this bad thing and it was all wrong and they were awful and blah, blah, blah. And actually that's doing part of you a real disservice because there can be beauty and there can be real pain. And it's like, can we hold the duality of it, that experience can both be incredibly painful and not what we truly want and simultaneously have real feelings.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting. And when we look at the trolls on Instagram and my post on having compassion for all people, I do think all people deserve compassion to and a chance to be seen and heard for their experience.
Yeah.
And I know not everyone feels that way, but yeah. I will die talking about that because I do think it's so important. We all deserve to sort of be seen and heard and have compassion for our experiences.
Yeah. We're all messy and wonderful and everything in between.
Yeah, for sure. And we're, you know, the women in these situations are really navigating stigma. I mean, we're all navigating stigma in our lives, right? But they're really navigating this. It's lonely. They're sort of branded as immoral and desperate and terrible people. And it's really isolating. And I think that's really sad because really we should be doing the opposite. We should be opening up our hearts and our minds and our communities for that bit of growth, for that understanding, for that. And if people actually opened up to the other woman, to the man having the affair, to the woman having, like, all of a sudden conversations are happening that maybe bring them to an understanding of themselves and that growth, that self-awareness and growth that comes from it.
Totally. Totally. Because I often think that a lot of when I was reading through in the first week when I was like addicted to reading the trolls and then I was like, stop, Lucy, this is not good for your mental health. When I was reading them, I was like, you can just feel how much pain these people are in. Mm-hmm. Like, and to your point around compassion, like for a lot of them, I was like, I actually feel really sad for them. I'm like, you clearly haven't had anyone to hold you in the experience that you've been through in life, which sounds like it's been very painful for you to come and attack me on the internet. That you must be holding something really painful to be attacking me. So
yeah. Have you ever heard the saying, hurt people hurt people?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I think that's something, you know, we see that a lot as psychologists. You know, in clinical psychology, we work with a lot of people who are hurt and then they do things that hurt other people. And I see that, especially with kids. I talk about that with parents. You know, some parenting ways are quite harmful for little kids and then they do that to others.
Yeah.
You know, you can see, like, especially if you go into sort of abusive situations, you see a kid getting abused, they abuse the dog.
Yeah.
You know,
hurt I mean, this hurt goes people. Into this whole, like,
yeah.
This, I just look at the world and it's like it's a constant spiral of just hurting people over and over and over again. And yeah, the pattern interrupt is compassion. It's like something I learned so much when I was studying with Gabor Mate was like, compassion, like over and over again. And I remember being in a practice session with one of the guys who was on the training with me, who was a clinical psychologist, and he worked in prisons. And he came to, like, we had to do practice sessions with each other. And he came to the session one day and was like, I found it really hard because I was working with a client and he had raped his wife, I think, and raped and murdered. And he was like, I couldn't find compassion in myself and I need to be able to access compassion for him to be able to heal. And I was like, oh my God, like the depth of capacity this man held to be able to be like, okay, let me look at myself here because I'm struggling in like therapeutic relationship. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was like, but that is like how incredible for that person to have someone to hold them and to be like, I see you in your pain and I see you for the underlying reasons of why you did this. And like,
yeah. And it doesn't mean that we feel it's okay. I think that's the key is I think people think, well, if I have compassion, like, let's go to what we're talking about, the other woman, if I have compassion for her, then I have to agree with people having affairs. And I don't agree with that. And it's like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
You don't have to agree with the behavior to have compassion for the person.
Yes.
And I think that's the key, right? So we don't have to, you can still believe that affairs are wrong and have compassion for the people in them.
1,000,000%. That feels like the most perfect place to end.
I think so.
Oh, Holly, thank you so much for coming on here and for sharing all of your wisdom with us. If people would like to find you, where can they find you?
Yeah. Well, you can find me. I kind of, my work is based around families and emotional intelligence. So I'm at Raising EQ on Instagram. And I'm, my website is www.raisingeq.com. And you can find me there. And I know a lot of people, I want to just highlight that a lot of people had asked me for my dissertation. And I'm actually having a really hard time finding the link online, but I thought I will PDF it. So if you would like that, shoot me an email. And I will send you the PDF and you can read it. I mean, it's very long. So
amazing. Thank you so much for offering that.
Of course. So
thank you so much, my lovely.
Bye.